years, and look around at the floods and tornadoes and fires that come close to home here, and droughts. And these experiences raise key theological questions, not least questions about God. How shall we speak of God's relation to natural disasters and the suffering and the death often that is related to such events? Is God responsible in any way for these disasters? Some good church people claim God is in absolute control of these events. And even more, God aims them sometimes at certain communities, exacting a divine punishment for sins named and unnamed. For example, you all know these. God aimed Hurricane Katrina right at New Orleans because of its behaviors over the years. I wonder, however, it's not such a viewpoint remarkably anthropocentric, human-centered. Do planetary collisions and stellar explosions occur because of human sin? I mean, seems to me that our increased knowledge of a long history of nature will not allow us to link human natural disasters to human sin in any consistent way. At the same time, some linkage with human sin seems to be in order. And if so, what kind of language would be helpful here? Theological reflection about God and natural disasters has been on the increase over the last generation or so. And two primary factors seem to be at work. One is the power of the media to bring the effects of such disasters from around the world right into our homes, onto our smartphones, day after day. It's right there. And a second factor is the increased environmental consciousness of our time, which has caught up the church and the larger culture in issues relating to the care of creation. So many people today, both within and without the church, would rightfully claim that human activities have disrupted the balance of the ecosystem of which we're a part. And they can point to various pieces like the depletion of the ozone layer, or global warming, or unnatural developments in the natural world, in the animal world, the spread of deadly diseases, the weather patterns that seem uncommonly violent. I mean, there's quite a list here. And human beings are often thought to be a problem, if not the problem, in the intensity of these events, if not their actual occurrence. So, and as we'll note, sinful human behaviors are often linked to some natural disasters in the Bible too. Can't get away from that. A long history of natural disasters could be cited to illustrate these themes. One thinks, for example, of the earthquake in Lisbon, Portugal, and on Sunday morning, 1755, the churches were full, many of them collapsed, and over 50,000 people were killed. What did God have to do with that event? Was it God's will that the earthquake, this specific earthquake, occur? Many think that to be the case. Others think differently, thankfully. John Polkinghorne, a British physicist and... do I have this on? Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
It'll help the recording a lot.
Okay. John Polkinghorne, who is a British physicist, theologian, develops these issues in a helpful way. Quote, God's will was that the elements of the earth's crust should behave in accordance with their nature. In other words, they're allowed to be in their own way just as we're allowed to be in ours, unquote. And Polkinghorne makes clear that this divine allowance, be careful of the word allow or permit, be careful, Polkinghorne makes clear that this divine allowance is a general allowance and not a specific allowance. Make sure you make that distinction in using the language of allow. God does not act directly, aiming such events at specific places. And Polkinghorne goes on like this: I do not believe that God directly wills either the act of a murderer or the incidence of a cancer or a natural disaster. I believe God allows, okay, general sense, these events to happen in a creation that's been given the gift of being itself. Such events are the inescapable cost of a creation allowed to be other than God, released from tight divine control and permitted, allowed to be itself. End quote. So Polkinghorne, if this be the case, what will we do with the biblical testimony regarding natural disasters? It's not surprising that the Bible's pages are filled with references to such disasters and to the ill effects experienced by people and animals and other creatures. One thinks of the stories of the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, numerous famines, plagues in Egypt, and you're just getting started. It's interesting, tomorrow we'll take a look at the book of Job, and the suffering experience of Job is almost entirely due to the effect of natural disasters. How might reflection on such text assist our theological consideration of natural disasters in our world and the associated suffering with both animals, spread to both animals and human beings? The Bible does portray God as involved in such natural disasters, and what are you going to do with it? One of the issues that I'll be working with in the next couple of days. Taking a look at the sheet, look at the side of the sheet entitled Genesis 1-2, God created the world good and not perfect. Let me read a couple of things and note the outline to which we'll attend here. My concern is to think closely about the kind of God depicted in Genesis 1 and 2, and in this presentation now, and to describe the nature of the creational moves that God makes. Given God's decision, we'll show this in a few minutes, given God's decision to create in community rather than alone, the key point, okay, I suggest some implications of that divine move for our reflections about God and the creation, God and the world of nature. God, the next paragraph, God shares power in relationship. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue the earth. Oh, no sin in the world. Subdue the earth. God shares power initially with the human beings, with other creatures for that matter, establishing an interdependent relationship with creatures in this respect to both originating creation we see now at the beginning of Genesis and continuing creation. God's approach to creation is communal. It's relational. That's why we spent yesterday working on the relationality issue, and has important implications for those created in the image of God in such a way. So then, looking at the first part of what follows here, for 6 points, and then we'll leave the other to later. Six types of textual evidence assist us in thinking about communal modes of creation in Genesis 1 to 2. I mean, how often is it we think God created the world alone? so awful in terms of its basic perspective. Just look at this. Number one, God uses already existing matter in creating new creatures. We'll illustrate these. Two, God invites already existing creatures to bring about new creation. We'll illustrate. Three, God calls upon the divine council, which is probably God and the angelic figures in the heavenly sphere. God calls upon the divine council to participate in creation. Let us create humankind. Four, God involves the human being in still further acts of creation. And go through the list of texts there. Number five, God evaluates the creation as good and very good, but not perfect. And six, God rested from all the work that he had done in creation. Just think about that for a minute. On the seventh day, God rested. God backed off from involvement in the creation and let the creation be what it was created to be without particular divine interference or attention. So that in these texts, God involves creatures in creaturely activity. So let's take a closer look now at some of those Genesis texts from a different perspective, perhaps, than is common. It's almost a chorus among commentators that God created the world alone. With overwhelming power, absolute control, working independently, unilaterally, making such claims about the Creator God constitutes a practical end to the conversation for many interpreters. It's God who's created, end of conversation. I invite you not to go there. If this understanding of the imaging of God in Genesis 1 and 2, for that matter, is correct, then those who are created in the image of this God could properly understand their role regarding the rest of the creation in comparable terms. Power over, absolute control, independence. That is, if all the creatures of Genesis 1 are understood to be but passive putty in the hands of God, doesn't that invite a comparable treatment of them by those created in the image of such a God? In other words, how one images the God of the creation accounts, and it's a problem, will have a significant impact on our view of the world, on our environmental sensitivities, and the urgency of our practices. What if the God of the creation accounts is imaged more as one who, in creating, chooses to share power? And then the way in which humans, as image of God, exercise dominion is shaped by that model. Even more, if the God of the creation accounts his image as one who also involves non-human creatures, as we'll see, in still further creations, then that should inform our understanding of the value, the great value, that they have been given by God. God catches them up in the creative process. God chooses not to do it alone. While creatures are deeply dependent upon God for their creation and life, God has chosen to establish an interdependent relationship with creatures with respect to creative activity. God's approach to creation is communal, it's relational, and in the wake of the initial activity, opening verses of Genesis 1, God's approach to creation is communal. It's relational. God works from within the world rather than on the world from without. And So God's word in creation is often a communicating word. It's not a top-down word. Creation texts, I want to show, I hope, is they show a sharp interest in God's part on sharing creative activity. God chooses not to do this alone. So I invite you to think of the kind of God who is depicted in these Genesis texts and what sort of creational moves this God makes. Initially, many would agree that natural events such as earthquakes and volcanoes and floods and destructive weather patterns, cell mutations, even deadly viruses, were an integral part of the creation before human beings even showed up. And so in some sense, such natural processes, which included a lot of destruction and pain and suffering for the animal world, were a part of God's good creative work from the beginning. So much potential for pain and suffering at the hands of nature existed in the pre-human, pre-sin world. And when human beings did show up, they were told to subdue the earth, which must mean that for all its goodness, God's creation was not to be a tranquil place. And then when human beings came along and sinned, that changed everything. But into these God-created orders, there was much potential for hurt and suffering before sin ever had a place. So from the opening verses of Genesis, we learn that the Spirit of God works with raw material. So that early verses of Genesis, the earth, the deep, the darkness, the waters, God works with these creatures, brings these creatures together, and in that activity, creation is animated. So you get this, the language of God's creative activity initially in Genesis 1, it suggests movement, energy, change, open-endedness. Where's this world going? And the spirit image in thinking about creation, the spirit image signals a dynamic creative process rather than a static creative process. It's an open process rather than one that's tightly controlled by God or anybody, huh? The Spirit of God works in the disorder of things, if you will, to bring about new life and new orderliness. And the opening verses of the Bible is a remarkable image of God. Huh? Natural disasters, I would say, are a key agent that God uses in the continuing creation of the world. Now, in what follows from that section in Genesis, we're told that creation is not a sudden act. God doesn't sort of snap the divine fingers and bring the creation into being. Creation is more drawn out. God takes time in the creating process. There was evening, and there was morning, one day, 2 days, 3 days. Bringing creation into being over a stretch of time. We don't know for sure how long those days are, but could be 24-hour days, could be a longer period of time. Creation, this time factor that's built into the becoming of the world signals that creation then is a dynamic process. It's not a finished product. God doesn't hand the creation over to the creatures in a bright red box and say, keep it exactly like it was at the end of the sixth day now.
Yeah.
Creation is ongoing. And one of the interesting things to me in these opening chapters of Genesis is that That God says, God catches the creatures up to participate with God in ever new creations. In day five, day six, God invites the creatures to be involved in the creative acts. For use example in Genesis 1:11-13, God invites, let the earth bring forth. And we're told, the earth brought forth. The earth, rather than God, is the subject of the creating verb. And then on days 5 and 6, God calls the waters and the earth to bring forth further creatures. And day 5 and 6, God is the subject of the creating birth that follows. But given the pattern that's set by Genesis 1:11-13, the co-participation of the waters and the earth in these acts of creation seems to be in view. And then on day 5, all living creatures are invited to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. God gives power over to the non-human to propagate their own kind. God has made a world in which creatures could make themselves. God invites the earth and the waters, and might we say the mountains and microorganisms and even natural disasters such as earthquakes and fires and storms, into the creative process. Just when I was here 30 years ago or so, and just participating in the beauty of this part of the world, who are the creator of this wonderful context of which we are a part? God gives the creative process over to that which is not God, and you get the involvement of the creator creatures themselves in the continuing creative process. Creative capacities are not uniquely human or divine, for that matter. In Genesis 1:26, God invites that which is other than God to participate in the creation of the human. Let us create humankind. At the climactic point of the creative process, then, God chooses not to act alone. So throughout these texts, God calls upon creatures other than God to bring about further acts of creation. God invites, then invites humankind into this process to be fruitful and multiply, and to fill the earth, subdue it. Before sin, there's clearly a disorderliness here about the earth that needs the attention of the creatures. What every creature does will count in the becoming of the world. And inasmuch as creatures are not perfect, they may not be sinful, but they're not perfect, things will need to be subdued. Human beings, for example, are finite. They're created with limits. And hence, what the creatures do will not be perfect. I mean, if human beings went to school before there was sin, they would not have scored 100% on every test they took. What a boring world that would have been. But what they do will count. What they do, the creatures do, will count in the becoming the world, and they will count with God. Each of us and other creatures, such as ants and earthquakes and volcanoes and typhoons, have a part to play in the creation of the world. God chooses not to do it alone. Hey, what is the effect of the creative involvement of such creatures? Let me pick up on Eugene Peterson here, who has a book that's not tended to very well, I think, at least in the literature that I've read. He's written, he's published so much, though, maybe more there than I realized. But in his book, Under the Unpredictable Plant, okay, it focuses on the book of Jonah. And he speaks of the mess of creativity. Quote, I can never be involved in creativity except by entering the mess. And here's a key sentence. Mess is the precondition of creativity. Yes. Mess is the precondition of creativity. And very refer you to a New York Times article and saying it's entitled Saying Yes to Mess. My wife doesn't like this particular article. This is New York Times, December 21st, 2006. It's very interesting to hear this reflection. It's a flippant remark, but if you've never had a messy kitchen, you probably never had a home-cooked meal. Mess is robust and adaptable as opposed to brittle. Mess is complete in that it embraces all sorts of random elements. Mess tells a story. You can learn a lot about people from the messes they make. Whereas neat is a closed book. Neat has no narrative. Huh? Mess is also natural and a real time saver. It takes extra effort to neaten up a system. Things generally don't neaten themselves. And she includes Einstein's oft-quoted remark, quote, if a cluttered desk is a sign of a cluttered mind, what then is an empty desk? God is present and active in this process, but at the same time, there's an open-endedness to which I think the work of the Spirit testifies, and in which the involvement of all these creatures in the creative process is a testimony. When the Spirit of God is at work, you can't apply time management techniques or hire efficiency experts. This is true also of the creative activity of non-human creatures. The Spirit working in and through existing matter enables genuine novelty to emerge. And for some disorder to persist beyond God's originating creativity is necessary. Disorder is necessary for the development of creation. One more comment, Joe, and then I'll get to you. Okay.
Was in design and architecture.
So can you speak up?
My first career was in design and architecture, and I still do a lot of design. And you have to have mess, and usually when I'm starting a project in whatever it is, textiles or anything, I love to spread everything out on the floor, sit in the middle of it, and just stare.
Sounds good.
Because it's the unexpected juxtaposition of things and textures and ideas that spark something.
Yeah, and spark imagination.
It's the unexpected that gives you the creativity. If it's all neat and clean, you're not going to get it.
Very good. Very helpful. Thank you. On the other hand, too much disorder can create havoc.
Yeah.
Okay. So, the word in the text is, subdue the earth. Okay. Tame the fires. And God rested on that seventh day. God let the world be what it was created to be in all of its creativity and mess. This theme of God creating in and through existing messy matter, if you will, is also present in Genesis 2. creation of woman. Genesis 2:7 has a remarkable image of God's involvement in this creative activity. God gets down on the ground and initially creates the creation of the man, and shapes the dust into a human being. God gets dirt under the divine fingernails, if you will. Okay? The ground in all of its messiness proves to be a crucial ingredient for the creation of human being. Human beings are not created out of nothing in this text, but out of already existing non-human creatures. And this creature has creative capacities. Let the earth bring forth. And the earth brought forth. Yes? Please.
When Jesus spits in the mud with the blind guy and puts mud on his eyes, is that supposed to connect us to this creative act?
Well, I think that I've not seen a particular study on that connection, but I think it's very helpful to make that connection. Mm-hmm. So that you do have the...
It's recreative.
It is. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Helpful. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. The ground, in all of its messiness, becomes a crucial ingredient for the creation of people like you and me. But this creature has creative capacities, huh? Or you move to the next creative move in Genesis 2, the creation of woman in particular. This down-to-earth image of God continues. God is portrayed as a surgeon. God puts Adam to sleep, removes a part of his body, and it's probably not a rib. We don't know for sure how to translate. It's probably the side of the man. And creates a woman. Listen, how often when you hear that text, do you recognize this is a bloody process? Can you imagine what kind of blood that would have brought forth to cut open the side of the man in order to bring out the rib or the side for the creation of a woman? What a bloody move by God. What a messy move by God in the creation of the woman, slicing open the side of the man. Such messiness is the way things commonly develop in the process of creation. So you get this kind of touchy, tactile engagement of God in the creative process. Get that image in your head. God getting down in the dirt and out of this mess begin, you know, creation is emerges. It's a very striking text, I think. At the end of each day of creation, then God looks out over the developing landscape and makes an evaluation of what the divine eyes have observed. It's good. It's good. It's very good. Would not God's creative work be perfect? Why not use the language of perfection?
It's not fair.
It's not fair. But we tend, when we speak about creation, tend to talk about God's work in creating can only issue in a perfect product.
Might we go back to the rib for a moment?
Sure.
When it says rib, are you challenging us or suggesting that the Hebrew word there has been translated this way, but there is more to it than that?
Yeah, if you were to take a look at the commentaries on this text, you would find rib is there and side is there, and it's people make decisions about how to translate it and so forth, but there is some indecision here with respect to what exactly the translation of that word is. It's uniquely used. And
so different manuscripts suggest different...
No, it's just the way in which you work with the understanding of that particular word. And so it's an ongoing conversation at the present time, whether we have a rib or side on our hands. I like the bloodier one, actually. There's nothing you can say that would absolutely determine how to translate it, at least the present knowledge that I'm aware of. And then to come back to subdue the earth, what would such a word mean in a time when there wasn't yet sin? I alluded to that. I think the word subdue means to bring order out of continuing disorder. The command to subdue assumes that the earth is not fully developed. There's no once and for all givenness to the nature of the creation at the end of the seventh day. The command to subdue by God is given in the service of developing God's creation more fully toward its fullest possible potential. So God's word, the word that you hear good, must not mean perfect, or there would be nothing left for human beings to subdue.
Yeah.
And this creation of God is a dynamic reality. Creating is a long-term project, ever in the process of becoming, as the history of nature shows. With the earth changing activities of such creatures, glaciers and fires and earthquakes, God builds this creative potential into the very structures of the world. And this means that over time the creation will look quite different than what it did in the seventh day. And this is what God intended. But we need to recognize the creativity of these creative matters. These ideas also suggest that for the proper development of creation, some disorder must persist in the wake of God's originating creative activity. One of the interesting Genesis commentators, Sibley Towner, in his commentary, Westminster Companion Commentary on Genesis, is a very interesting, it doesn't develop it, but it's a very interesting comment about these opening verses in Genesis. If there were no freedom in the creation, no touches of disorder, boy, just take a look at the discussions of the opening chapters of Genesis, everything's orderly. Yeah, okay. He says that if there are no touches of disorder, no open ends, then moral choice, creativity, and excellence could not arise. And the world would be a monotonous cycle of inevitability, a dull as dishwater world of puppets and automatons. So the disorder is important for the creativity involvement in the development of the world. So, give me a couple sentences and then it will come to you, Joe. The mess of creativity is necessary for the creative development of the world, rather than a meticulous blueprint. Okay? God does not paint by numbers. Okay. God gives to creation, to the creatures, human and non-human, the continuing capacity to be itself, to be what it was created to be, also to develop into something more, the potential. And so the spirit working in and through existing matter and other creatures enables becoming, enables genuine novelty to emerge in the story of creation. And so this order, this ongoing disorder in the world is a good thing. Disorder is good. Not least because it contributes significantly to the ongoing creative process. So this suggests that disorder should be subdued but not eliminated. But this creational reality, coming to it, okay, this creation reality means that God created a world filled with dangers. God created a world filled with dangers. Think water. It's necessary for life, absolutely necessary for life, but it's dangerous. Think the law of gravity. Absolutely essential for life, but it works every time. God created a dangerous world.
And called it good.
Huh?
And called it good.
Yes, right, exactly. Exactly. All sorts of possibilities for suffering are part of the creative process in the beginning of the world. But one reason at least for that divine move, I think, is the increase in the potential for creativity and beauty, however costly it might be over time. God created a dangerous world, but a creative world. So we would have to be very careful, I think, not to ascribe all of the potentially dangerous elements of the world with which we're surrounded as a product of sin. That's a part of the way that God created the world. Joel, why?
Well, I'm thinking that creativity also involves risk.
Yeah.
Because you don't always know the outcome. So this would imply then, right, that God had taken a huge risk with all of this.
Yeah. I think risk is a good word. God doesn't stay in absolute control of what happens in the creation. God creates and lets the creatures develop, be what they were created to be. And you might say this is a self-limiting move on God's part. Self-limiting move. Power-sharing move. For the sake of a relationship of integrity. So God gives to the human being and to other creatures a key role in the ongoing development of the creation, of bringing the world along to its fullest possible development. So you've got a number of open possibilities in which human and non-human activity will prove crucial for the ongoing development of the world. So taking care of the environment is an important process, but that activity is not simply a matter of attempting to keep the creation as unchanged as possible, because it would be less creative. And what it means to take care of the environment, of course, is a constantly changing reality. There was a hand right. Yes, please.
So we were wrong when we always said that when God says, let us create, it's not the royal it's more, it's us as well.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that. That is a tradition that's often about, that if it's a royal, we let us create humankind. But the vast majority of scholars are saying that's not a royal we, because simply in the rest of the Bible, the use of the royal we is rare, if not non-existent. Mm-hmm. And so it's this is more complicated. It has to do with a divine community of God and other angelic figures that become involved in the process. You can see it also in the remaining chapter of Genesis 1 to 11 about that use of the plural in God's speech illustrates that. Yeah?
Terry, when you talked about that humans were to subdue the earth, would that word be similar to have dominion over the earth? Mm-hmm. Except do it in terms of use it for your purposes, your needs.
Yeah, I think that the language of subduing and having dominion are integral to one another. But I think it gets into an involved discussion at that point. But my point here is that you've got a good world where it's not a perfect world. That sort of language, I think, illustrates. And so, I don't know, I didn't welcome this kind of reflection and thinking about that God's, this self-limiting move on God's part, involving that which is not God in the creative process, is risky. And human creatures in their finitude will make mistakes, that fall short, even in the use of their creative potential. And so whether in view of human finitude, that is to say, human limits, or in view of human sin comes along, giving the human such a level of participation in ongoing creation is a risky move for God. Yeah.
Maybe that explains the flood story a little bit more, because God says, "I'm regretting that I've done this."
Yeah, It does. And so you get a promise. You get a promise at the end of the flood story. I'm never going to do that again.
Right. Yeah.
Well. So very striking language. Yes, please. Go ahead.
I was thinking about the subdue again. A current controversy, northwestern Minnesota, eastern North Dakota, the Red River Valley, Army Corps of Engineer wants to do some reconstruction dams and so on to avoid flooding Fargo so often, Fargo-Moorhead. Well, then the farmers are upset because that would mean their fields get flooded instead. So what is subduing the earth to one person is risky to someone else.
Yeah. It invites a conversation.
Yeah.
More than one conversation.
Yeah.
And that would be true of life generally, of course, so that wouldn't be unusual.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Finitude, mortality, and sin in Genesis 3. When does mortality, is it, so risk from the beginning, I could always climb a mountain. I would have, prior to the fall, if I fell off it, it would still kill me.
Yeah, chances are pretty great.
my mom is all about death happened on account of the fall.
Yeah.
And that's pretty common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, but I think don't finally go there. I mean, that's a larger conversation.
That's a pretty darn big argument, actually. One of those things we avoid at my house.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Paul, for them. Yeah.
Okay, I just think it's a very helpful context for pastoral care, because it's always messy. And over against this view of the world that was perfect and then broken. You know, I have a colleague at home who learned in her 20-week ultrasound that her baby has a congenital heart defects. Mm-hmm. And the doctors are so at pains to say this just happens. You know, it's not your age, it's nothing you did.
Speak up a moment.
It's the congenital heart defects are not her age or anything she did. And it, to
to know the risk, danger of creativity always embedded in this text is, I think, freeing from some of those questions.
Yeah, and those kinds of health situations are so common, at least in my experience, where the conversation goes, what did I do?
Exactly.
You know, to bring this particular illness or whatever condition about.
The flip side is we want the control so it won't happen again. Or I mean, we want the control. Partly it's a blame thing, but partly it's a, how can I make this so it doesn't hurt anymore again?
So?
No, you can't.
The creativity is always being shut down.
Yeah, please.
My question has to do with other creation stories. This is the Jewish, the Hebrew creation story. You know, I've heard other creation stories that aren't as involved. They don't give us this messy picture, but is that just because they've been simplified? And
well, the other creation stories in the Middle East, for example, would include messy characteristics. Maybe there are some that don't at all. There's so many. So virtually every culture has a creation story or a developing story.
Right. And do they all sort of see that these natural disasters and these bad things that happen are just part of life rather than created by God necessarily? I mean, pinpointing punishment or something like that.
I'm not familiar enough with all those creation stories to be able to respond to that, but it would be an interesting conversation to pursue, indeed.
Yeah. Smart fools,
yeah.
Stories.
Indeed. Yeah, please.
Being here yesterday evening and today, it seems like what you're really trying to get at is that there's the freedom that God has, but he has his own rules of engagement with humanity, and so we don't look to God as the making something perfect that now has been denied. I don't know if it inherent in the in, if it, I don't know if we had to have the world not be perfect for that to still be true, right? I mean, and I've always heard the when he says making in our image, he's not referring to the heavenly hosts. He's referring to the Trinity. Uh-huh. So I just wanted to throw that out. And then also have you help a little bit with the whole, you're piggybacking off the death thing and sin. There's a lot in there about you're living without death before the fall. So I want to unpack that a little bit, if you could.
Yeah. It's an ongoing conversation. Who knows where it will emerge finally. But I think that issues of, when in Genesis 3, is to pick up on one text in the larger context, when after the eating of the tree,
mm-hmm.
The fruit of the tree, and it's so, verse 16 through 16, to the woman he said, I will greatly increase your pangs in childbearing. Not that you're going to get pain where you didn't have before. It's the pain that you experience will be increased in view of what has happened.
Right.
In pain you shall bring forth children. So that's the sort of connections, I think, that need to be explored a little bit. I don't think finally that the text will allow us to say for certain about death before sin, but I think that there is enough textual evidence to suggest, hey, this is something that needs greater consideration than has been the case here before.
Mm-hmm.
Just quickly, I'm not a counselor, but I think that one of the key definitions of love and being in a loving relationship with another person is to allow that person, you know, to be themselves. You cannot love something, probably by definition, that you can totally control. And the more autonomy and power you give to that other person, the greater that love can be. And it seems to me like here God is taking on a similar kind of relationship with humans. God knows he can't love something, perhaps, that he can totally control, they can lay out a blueprint for. He has to give away, he has to be, I mean, not all-powerful to some extent.
Yeah. That's clearly a limitation of the exercise of power on God's part. It's clearly a move here. That's important. And that's important for the emergence of genuine relationship, I think, is an important word to hear. Yes, please.
She said that God might have regretted what he did when he had the flood. Is that what he thinks every time there's a natural disaster?
Yeah.
Or, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. It's interesting that the language of divine regret is right there at the beginning of the flood story in chapter 6. And it occurs elsewhere, 39 times or whatever it is in the Old Testament. One has to kind of explore what the divine regret might mean here.
Both at the beginning and at the end of the flood story.
Hmm. Yes. He regretted
creating him in time, so he sent the flood, and then regretted sending the flood.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I'll never do that again.
Right. And human beings are just as sinful at the end of the flood story as they are at the beginning of the flood story, so what good are all that construction doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, striking images. Well, I think our time is up for today, so thank you very much, and we'll continue the conversation. And tomorrow I want to talk about Job. I think that's an important conversation.